All rise. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Mr. Sullivan, Major Johns. Good morning, afternoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I did the morning, all right. And Colonel Cordova, Mr. Bruce. I understand you're reserving 5 minutes, is that correct, Mr. Bruce?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, you may proceed in the case of U.S. v. Senior Airman Scrady.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Roger Bruce. Colonel Cordova and I have the privilege of representing the United States in this matter. The military judge abused her discretion by excluding appellee's random and consent drug testing reports on the basis of the Melendez-Diaz case. Three main points this afternoon. First, we'd like to briefly discuss the current state of the law that does apply here as set forth in Magyari and Blazer, binding precedent, binding upon the military judge and the fact that she abused that her discretion by failing to follow that law. Second, we'd like to, of course, discuss Melendez-Diaz and how it is easily distinguishable from the facts of this case, both factually and legally. The military judge erred by relying upon it, and we'd like to demonstrate that fact today. Finally, we'd also like to draw your attention to the Fourth Circuit Washington case, which provides great persuasive authority for this court in the use of experts and drug testing reports from Department of Defense laboratories like the one in this case. Before we get to those three main points, just briefly to touch on the standard of review here. Of course, with evidentiary rulings, it's abuse of discretion. We're all well aware of that. But this is in fact, a government appeal. The facts are governed by the clearly erroneous standard. The facts the judge found in her written findings aren't erroneous in themselves, but as we'll demonstrate today, the facts she ignored caused her to form an erroneous conclusion of law. And it's that conclusion of law that this court reviews de novo. So on the conclusion of law, she is entitled to no deference. Did she get the law correct? And the answer will be no. She must be reversed. First, briefly, the current state of the law. This case is decisively governed by Magyari and Blazer, two cases that were decided after the Crawford case from the Supreme Court, a very important point, post-Crawford cases from CAF and this court. Crawford, of course, overruled Ohio versus Roberts, a point I'll talk about more in just a moment. In Magyari, CAF held under Crawford that a random drug test result is not a testimonial statement for purposes of the Sixth Amendment. And in Blazer, this court came to the exact same conclusion, post-Crawford, that a random and consent drug testing reports were not testimonial statements for purposes of the Sixth Amendment. That is the current state of the law. No court of competent jurisdiction has reversed either this court or CAF, and the judge was required to follow that law.
Before you go on, I'd like to ask, in this case, the judge made a ruling that anything beyond the initial screen, so rescreen on, made the testimony, but those were testimonial things, and she was going to require all the witnesses to come in. What's your position about that?
Well, she did reach that finding as to one of the drug testing reports, the random test. That was her conclusion. On the consent, she said anybody who touched it had to come in. If the judge would have looked carefully at the Melendez-Diaz case, she would have concluded that that is simply not required by the law. Her ruling was, in fact, legally erroneous. Careful reading of Melendez-Diaz will establish that point. And I'll move to that, if I may, Your Honor. Melendez-Diaz is easily distinguishable, both factually and legally, here today. The judge relied upon it, quite frankly, in an attempt to overrule her superior court, something that should not be allowed to stand. She failed to read the opinion carefully, and in doing so, she misapplied and overextended the Supreme Court's intent in Melendez-Diaz. Factually, legally distinguishable. The narrow question in Melendez-Diaz was whether an ex parte affidavit used to convict was in fact testimonial, making the affiance witnesses in the case, subject to confrontation. That issue isn't raised here. First, factually, it's a very different case. In Melendez-Diaz, The defendant was prosecuted for distributing and trafficking in cocaine. As part of an undercover police investigation, they seized the defendant's cocaine. They sent it off to a state police crime laboratory to determine, was his cocaine in fact cocaine? And the lab was required by law to test it when they received something from the police. It was a police crime lab doing a police drug test. As provided under Massachusetts law, prosecutors were allowed to simply put in a piece of paper saying his cocaine was in fact cocaine. Didn't call any expert witnesses to explain, interpret, or describe the testing. In fact, the Supreme Court noted the defendant didn't even know what tests were conducted based on the document that was used to convict him. He just had a simple, bare-bones piece of paper that said, this is cocaine. The Supreme Court of Melendez-Diaz placed great emphasis on that bare-bones nature of the document. In this case, though, the trial counsel was not relying upon a bare-bones affidavit. He was relying upon a detailed drug testing report. He was relying upon qualified expert testimony that the defense didn't have any problem with. They didn't voir dire or challenge the expert qualifications. And the trial counsel was using that expert testimony to fully explain, interpret, and admit the test results.
Colonel, in the second test, prosecution two, I believe.
Yes, Your Honor.
That sample was marked with the code PC, probable cause, as I recall. And that was on the sample that went to the lab initially. As I recall the facts, the folks in the room that pour the urine would have seen the PC code, but no one else. Is that correct?
That is a correct statement of Dr. Bruin's testimony, that only the initial people who poured would even be aware of the basis. Anybody after that point simply had no idea how that test came to the laboratory.
That was my question. If you could just give me your view on how labeling a sample PC and then that's seen by people who initially aliquot urine would change, if at all, the analysis under Crawford and its application and Magyari and Parkrow on the other hand.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure how significant it is, but as I look at Prosecution Exhibit 2, I see it says VO. I'm not quite sure from the record what VO stands for, but just so we're real clear, PC was not on Prosecution Exhibit number 1. But I don't think, quite frankly, that it matters because it's well established in the record here and, quite frankly, in the analysis from this court in Blazer and the analysis in CAF and Magyari, that the lab does the same process and procedure each and every time. These are an anonymous test as far as the lab technicians are concerned. They don't know anything about the members tested. They don't have access to their name, their medical records, to whether or not they're part of some law enforcement informant activity. They know nothing about any particular member. And that's why this testing is different than what was done in Melendez-Diaz. They had a known subject with known or suspected cocaine being sent to a police laboratory as opposed to the Department of Defense laboratory, which is based on their ultimate goal is ensuring mission readiness of our armed forces.
Well, let me ask you this. Maybe on the initial screen that's true, but what about the two after that, the two tests after that? Isn't it that they're presumptive positive when they get put in with those hundred samples?
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but as this court noted in Blazer, even then the technicians don't know anything about any particular specimen because the specimens are tested along with specimens from other individuals. They're tested along with what are known as blind quality control specimens, negative positive control specimens, and quality control samples from the lab itself. They have no idea of whether any particular test is going to, in fact, result in a positive test. So their data entries, which is all that we're really talking about here, really don't give them a reasonable expectation that they're bearing testimony against somebody in some future criminal trial.
I have a question about the second test. In the record, it indicates that there was some problem at the lab with the testing, and it had to be rerun.
Correct.
And
yes,
then there was much testimony with respect to, I guess, a false positive, some six-month window around when the accused in this case had his urine tested. when you look at Melendez-Diaz and they talk about people in the lab who aren't infallible and the necessity to have these witnesses, what's your position on that?
Well, Your Honor, the discrepancy that you referred to was actually a minor discrepancy as identified by Dr. Bruins, the expert witness.
Not minor to the person who was reported positive that wasn't.
Your Honor, there's two different discrepancies.
Oh, you're talking about the one in the actual test.
That's correct. The actual test. The one in Appley's case was, in fact, a minor discrepancy that, in the expert's opinion, did not affect the accuracy of the specimen. But as far as the more serious allegation that the judge spent a great deal of time cross-examining, quite frankly, the expert on, I think that actually proves the point here that there's no Sixth Amendment problem. You'll note that there are over 40 pages of cross-examination by the defense counsel here. The Sixth Amendment was not violated. There was a full and fair cross-examination demonstrated in this record of trial already. The additional inquiry by the military judge made it very plain for all to see that confrontation was in fact being had by the appropriate person, an expert, fully qualified about the entire process of the lab, the DTRs. He knew everything about this, and the defense accepted him as an expert. There was proper confrontation. Yeah, there was a problem, but that proves the point that there wasn't a Sixth Amendment violation here. There was, in fact, proper confrontation under the Sixth Amendment. And frankly, it wouldn't do any good to bring the lab technicians to testify in this case. As it's well established, there's almost 1 million tests conducted by this laboratory each year. There's no way, as Dr. Rhoda said in her affidavit, that any lab tech is going to come in and say, yeah, I remember Airman Screed's urine specimen and how we tested it that day. First, they don't know Airman Screed. He's an anonymous individual as far as they're concerned. But when you're testing nearly 1 million samples a year, you're not going to remember the specifics about any particular specimen. What would they be able to do at most? They'd be able to come in and say, here are the procedures we follow each and every time. And that's exactly what the expert was there to testify. Here are the procedures we follow each and every time. Confrontation was not violated here. The appropriate amount of confrontation was had, and it's well demonstrated in this record of trial. Back to Melendez-Diaz. It's easily distinguishable here for many reasons. And I know we've covered it in our brief, but I want to hit some of the high points, if I may, quickly here. The legal distinctions are equally compelling in Melendez-Diaz. First, we believe Justice Thomas's concurring opinion is quite compelling. This was a fragmented court, 5-4 decision. And as we indicated in our brief, when the court's fragmented, we're required to look at the most narrow interpretation of those in the majority. And that's Justice Thomas's very short opinion where he said, quote, the confrontation clause is implicated by extrajudicial statements only insofar as they're contained in formalized testimonial materials such as affidavits, depositions, prior testimony, confessions. The court concluded, quote, that the documents in Melendez-Diaz were, quote, quite plainly affidavits, therefore the confrontation clause applied. A very narrow holding, Your Honors. The case stands for nothing more than this. DTRs are not affidavits, deposition, prior testimony, or confessions. It is our position that Melendez-Diaz does not overrule Maggiore or Blazier. The military judge recognized Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in her conclusions of law and then, quite frankly, completely disregarded it. But there's other important explicit limitations in Melendez-Diaz that we think bear mentioning. Justice Scalia's opinion, he noted, quote, this case involves little more than the application of our holding in Crawford. The Sixth Amendment does not permit the prosecution to prove its case via ex parte out-of-court affidavits, and the admission of such evidence against Melendez-Diaz was error. Again, CAF in this court has already decided post-Crawford that random and consent drug testing reports do not equate to testimonial statements requiring Sixth Amendment confrontation. And Melendez-Diaz did nothing to change this court or CAF's court, or CAF's opinion. This appellee will not be convicted by an affidavit. It should have been obvious to the military judge but she was in fact mistaken. There's more. Footnote 1. Once again, she recognized footnote 1 in her conclusions of law and then proceeded to disregard it completely. Footnote 1, of course, indicates that prosecution does not have to call witnesses to establish, quote, the chain of custody, authenticity of the sample, or accuracy of the testing device. Dr. Bruins testified that that's exactly what the lab personnel do in this case. They make sure the machines are working properly. They make sure that the results are accurately reported. That's what the lab does. She knew about footnote 1 and then proceeded to disregard it. And she was compelling the government to bring 21 of the 50 lab employees to come testify in this one case. Now, that fact alone isn't dispositive just because it really hurts the government, but I think that further demonstrates the abuse of discretion by this military judge, because she didn't give careful attention to the Melendez-Diaz opinion. But there's still more limitation in Melendez-Diaz, because the court noted that calling lab techs isn't the only way you can get a drug testing result in. The Supreme Court left wide open the door to other testimony that CAF and this court has already crossed through in Magyari and Blazier. The use of random and consent drug testing reports coupled with expert testimony satisfies the Confrontation Clause. It has for decades, it has for many, many airmen, and in the United States' opinion, it still does. I'll discuss it more in a minute, time permitting, the Fourth Circuit's Washington court, the Fourth Circuit's Washington case, which is another Sixth Amendment vehicle that the Supreme Court allowed to stand just days after the Melendez-Diaz opinion. Melendez-Diaz is easily distinguishable from Magyari and Blazier, but we suggest Melendez-Diaz is actually closer to the Harcrow case cited by the defense counsel in their brief. In both Melendez-Diaz and Harcrow, there was a probable cause seizure and testing of physical objects, facts not present here. Both cases involved lab techs at state crime labs who knew the objects tested came from a known suspect, facts not present here. Both cases involved tests and furtherance of law enforcement investigations, facts not present in the appellee's random drug testing report, although arguably at play in his consent test. Both cases did not involve routine or objective cataloging of unambiguous factual matter, facts not applicable to appellee's case, where the lab routinely and objectively tests nearly a million such specimens anonymously each and every year. So we have a Sixth Amendment spectrum with Melendez-Diaz and Harcrow on one side, the Sixth Amendment in the middle, and Magyari and Blazier on the other end. Appellee's case is squarely on the Magyari and Blazier side of this spectrum.
Is it your view that applying Crawford and its progeny up through Melendez-Diaz, our focus should not be on the circumstances of the sample's collection, probable cause, random consent, what have you, but on the circumstances of the sample's testing?
Well, yes, Your Honor. In fact, I think there's great logic behind that, because the question is the document at issue testimonial in nature or not? And we're talking about a document from the drug laboratory, so you would want to focus on what did the drug lab, how were they involved in the creation of this document?
Is there any circumstance that you can imagine, as far as the collection, that would transform the case into a confrontation problem under Crawford, assuming that you use the same process at AFUTL?
Well, Your Honor, we think, because the focus ought to be on the lab, and you've got a lab that anonymously tests about a million people a year, and they follow the same procedures each and every time, frankly, and they don't even know what the basis is, frankly, the basis should not matter. These facts are not before this court, of course, but one might argue that a probable cause test ought to come to a different result, but we're not even sure that that's the case, quite frankly, where, once again, they follow the same procedures anonymously. They don't know the basis, so, quite frankly, I'm not sure how important the basis is in its collection. There is some language in Magyari that indicates a possible warning about law enforcement involvement in the collection of the specimen. We acknowledge that, but under the facts of this case, we've got an individual who consented. There would not have been a test but for his consent. Moreover, he litigated the voluntariness of his consent before this same military judge, and she concluded that, in fact, his consent was voluntary. It's hard to imagine any kind of potential for abuse by the police under these circumstances, where he consented and the judge ruled that it was, in fact, voluntary consent. There's simply no potential for abuse under those circumstances, and certainly no reason to suggest that his consent drug testing report is somehow testimonial, because it started with a request from the security forces investigator.
I guess that's what I was getting at. Under your view of Crawford, does it matter what happened at the base if the lab uses the same procedures on every test?
It does not, Your Honor. It frankly does not matter. It does not matter.
During the trial and when the expert was testifying and talking about how the urine is processed in the drug lab, was there testimony that described the chain of custody forms and the machines that do the testing and reports that get generated and the timing of all of that?
I'm not quite sure I follow your question. You mean, did they go page by page? And
did they discuss how this report comes to be? You know, the urine comes to the lab, and there's a chain of custody form that started, and then it goes to the next place, and a machine runs a test. And are these things happening as the sample's being processed, or are we looking at something that got put together when the justice section called the lab and said, I need a drug report?
Well, I don't know that those facts were fully developed on the record, because the government didn't call its local chain of custody witnesses, didn't get that far. Defense had filed their motion to exclude the drug testing reports prior to trial, and that was one of the first things that they took up. So I don't know that the record is well developed on that point, Your Honor. That's my recollection of the record. Yes, ma'am. I'd like to talk about the Washington case, if I may, for a moment. We find it to be a very persuasive opinion. Because, again, Melendez-Diaz said calling lab techs is not the only way to admit drug testing results. And CAF, again, and this court, again, have already decided post-Crawford that we're okay under the Sixth Amendment in random and consent cases. We believe that CAF and this court's opinions are well supported by the reasoning contained in the Washington court opinion, Washington case, rather. Although the Supreme Court did not actually issue an opinion in the Washington case, we still find it quite remarkable that they denied certiorari just 4 days after Melendez-Diaz was issued. Furthermore, Washington was cited by Judge Ryan in her concurring opinion in Harcrow. We believe Washington's very persuasive and fully supports Maggiore and Blazier. We discuss it extensively in our brief, but just to hit some of the high points, Washington involved a consent drug test taken after the suspect had been stopped by police in the Baltimore-Washington Parkway for suspicious behavior. The expert from AFIP, another Department of Defense drug testing laboratory, relied upon the raw data generated by machines printed out on pieces of paper to give his expert testimony that the appellant in that case had drugs and alcohol in his system. They didn't put in the drug testing report. They just called the expert witness, who then articulated his expert opinion about those results. In the interest of time, we rely heavily on our brief in Washington, but suffice it to say that this appellee's urine samples were tested by machines. It seems that perhaps the appellee would ultimately like to bring the GCMS machine into the courtroom and cross-examine the machine, because that's what, in fact, detected his drugs. But the lab's role was to ensure the machines were working properly, to ensure the results were accurately reported. They didn't do the testing themselves. They didn't independently determine or verify or deny the presence of drugs in his system. The machines did that. The machines contemporaneously printed out pieces of paper that demonstrated what the machines found. And the expert, Dr. Bruins, was there to provide his expert opinion based upon what the machine had to say to the expert. For these same reasons in the Fourth Circuit case, that court persuasively rejected confrontation claims and found it permissible for the expert to testify about drug testing results. In our system, we go even further than what the Washington court did. The Washington court blessed just bringing in the expert. We bring an expert, but we also put in the drug testing report and all the graphs and the data and the machine-generated information. In this case, the inculpating statement was that his urine contained marijuana and cocaine came from machines on printed paper given to Dr. Bruins. The lab personnel didn't personally affirm or deny the presence of drugs. The machines did. There were no statements from out-of-court declarants, and therefore no Sixth Amendment violation. Washington is based on the same premise as Maggiore and Blazer, and the Supreme Court let it stand 4 days after it released Melendez-Diaz. Washington is good law. Washington is persuasive law.
I'll toss you a real softball. The Washington court, as I recall, said that since they're statements of machines, they are not statements of persons even subject to a confrontation analysis.
Absolutely.
We don't even get to a hearsay analysis. I would assume you agree with that view of the law on hearsay, that statements of machines are not even subject to such a
we
hearsay
do,
analysis.
We do, Your Honor. We find great persuasion in the analysis in Washington. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mentioned at the beginning the judge, see my red light's on. I'll quickly close out here and come back to you. I'll come back to you in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. Mr. Sullivan?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Brandon, may it please the court. It's important to note at the outset exactly what issue was in front of this court. Judge Townsend made a number of rulings on the 3rd of September. The government appealed only one of them. The only issue the government appealed was whether the military judge erred by denying the government proffer of prosecution exhibits 1 and 2 for identification. The government could have but did not appeal the military judge's grant of the defense motion to exclude. And much of Mr. Bruce's argument was based on a challenge to that issue, which the government did not appeal. Article 62A2 says an appeal of any order or ruling may not be taken unless the trial counsel provides the military judge with written notice of appeal from the order or ruling within 72 hours of the order or ruling. And if we look at Appellate Exhibit 16 in the record, which is the notice of appeal filed by the trial counsel, the only issue stated on there, one, the United States intends to appeal the military judge's decision to deny the government's offer to admit prosecution exhibits 1 and 2 for identification, drug testing reports for accused urine samples obtained by random testing and consent testing respectfully. They obviously should be respectively. And that's it. So the only issue before this court is whether the military judge abused her discretion by not admitting prosecution exhibits 1 and 2 for identification. Anything the military judge said about who has to come in and testify is not before this court. The only issue is whether PE 1 and 2 should have been admitted. And the answer to that question is no. The military judge did not abuse her discretion by denying the government's offer. And it's black letter law that if those prosecution exhibits are inadmissible in any respect, the appellant cannot be heard to complain on appeal that some parts of it may be admissible. If it's inadmissible in any respect, it doesn't come in, Your Honor. And the military judge did not abuse her discretion by excluding it. Now, both prosecution exhibits 1 and 2 for identification contain testimonial hearsay.
But where? I've looked.
Oh, Your Honor.
And I looked on every page, and I see chain of custody documents. I see signatures. Where are the statements?
Your Honor, first, on the very first page of Prosecution Exhibit 1 for identification, in the result line that lines up with Senior Airman Scrady's Social Security number, is handwritten THC. A machine didn't put that in there. A person made the statement that the result of his test was THC.
This is a chain of custody document.
Your Honor, it reflects a result. It says result. So if you give this document to a member, That member is going to see the result, THC, and most importantly, Your Honor, that member will also see this certification. And it says, certification, I certify that I am a laboratory official, that the laboratory results indicated on this form were correctly determined by proper laboratory procedures, and they are correctly annotated. That, Your Honor, is a testimonial statement.
It's chain of custody. I don't see any affidavit. I don't see any. When you look at Melendez-Diaz, it was an affidavit that said this person tested positive and gave the result. This is not an affidavit. I don't even see the usual business record affidavit that we would see on the front of the drug testing report.
Your Honor, you'll recall that in Melendez-Diaz, when the Supreme Court was discussing affidavit, they turned to Black's Law Dictionary to define affidavit. And Black's Law, and what we have in this document, on page 1 of both Prosecution Exhibit 1 and 2, is a statement labeled certification. And the Black's Law Dictionary of certification is the act of attesting, the state of having been attested, and an attested statement. Black's Law Dictionary definition of the term attested is to bear witness testimony. So this is, quote, to bear witness testify. So literally the dictionary definition of a certification is testimonial. And additionally, the certifications on these documents easily satisfy the test that both the majority set out in Davis versus Washington, and Justice Thomas's separate view in Davis versus Washington, as well as his concurrence in Melendez-Diaz. Justice Thomas said that he looks into whether something is formalized. The test that he sets out is something Mirandized or custodial or accompanied by a similar indicia of formality. And that's what he actually wrote in his Melendez-Diaz concurrence. In his Davis dissent, while he was discussing what is formalized, he said confessions are, quote, formalized into signed documents. And here we have a signed certification by Ms. Vallon on Prosecution Exhibit 1. We have a signed certification by Mr. Dev on Prosecution Exhibit 2. Those are formalized statements. Again, the dictionary definition of a certification, it is testimony. It bears witness. Additionally, the majority in Davis said that their test of whether something reflected sufficient solemnity to qualify under the Establishment Clause, or under the Confrontation Clause, turned in part on it was well established that severe consequences can attend a deliberate falsehood. And in this record, we have testimony from Dr. Bruins, the deputy director of the lab, on page 44 of the record, indicating the severe consequences that would befall someone that filled out a certification negligently or knowing it was false. So again, this certification meets both the dissent from Davis and the majority from Davis definition of what is a formalized statement.
Mr. Sullivan, I want to go back to your earlier point that you began with, that the issues regarding Melendez-Diaz are not before the court. Was that your pitch?
No, Your Honor.
What was this argument that the judge only excluded the admissibility of these documents and the government failed to properly appeal it? What was that?
Your Honor, the military judge made, I guess, 4 rulings on the 3rd of September. Two of them implicated Melendez-Diaz. Okay.
Right.
The first ruling she made, temporarily, was that she granted the defense motion to exclude the drug testing reports.
Right.
The government did not appeal that ruling. Subsequently, the trial counsel offered the exhibits into evidence.
Right.
He actually offered Prosecution Exhibits 1 and 2 into evidence. I believe it was on page 165 of the record. And the military judge said no. Those documents, she denied that motion. That is the only, she denied that offer, I'm sorry, not motion, she denied that offer. That is the only ruling that the government appealed.
But on page 185, in ruling on that offer by the government, the judge says, consistent with my ruling on the motion, Prosecution Exhibits 1 and 2 for identification will not be admitted.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you don't think that's sufficient to bootstrap the ruling on the motion?
Oh, certainly not, Your Honor. The Article 62, it sets out a jurisdictional requirement.
Okay, go ahead. I just want to make sure I understood what you're saying.
But, Your Honor, I think that's a point worth following up. Article 62 sets out a jurisdictional requirement that the government has to specify the...
That's fine. Proceed back to the other argument.
Okay, yes, Your Honor. The certification in both of these instances indicates that the laboratory results indicated on this form were correctly determined by proper laboratory procedures. That's not a chain of custody statement. That individual at the drug testing lab is saying this result is accurate, and any member would understand that to be the case.
Except the top of the form, I don't have the record, but it talks about custody. It's chain of custody. It's, you know, it...
Your Honor, it's called a specimen custody document, but again, it says results, THC. Any member is going to understand that that means that tetrahydrocannabinol was found in appellant's urine, which means that it was positive for marijuana. And again, it includes something that is labeled a certification, which is a testimonial statement in and of itself, and that testimonial statement attests to the that the lab reports were properly followed. And it's also interesting to note when that statement was made there. Judge Thompson, you had asked about the whether these statements were made basically contemporaneously with the testing. And it's interesting to see what happened with the first test. It was received by, the urine sample was received by Brooks Lab on the 17th of November 2008. The initial immunoassay was performed on the 1st of December 2008. The rescreen was performed on the 2nd of December 2008. The GCMS was performed on the 3rd of December of 2008. And then Ms. Vallon certified, she entered that certificate on the 4th of December 2008. So this was not contemporaneously with the test, Your Honor. It was 3 days after the initial immunoassay, 2 days after the rescreen, and 1 day after the GCMS. And if you look at the second exhibit, you'll find that it's comparable. There, the sample was received on the 15th of December 2008. The initial immunoassay was conducted on the 24th of December. The rescreen was conducted on the 29th. It had two GCMSs, the first of which was on 30 December, the second of which was on 31 December. And then the certification was on the 2nd of January. So there it was 9 days after the initial immunoassay, 4 days after the rescreen, and 2 days after the completion of the GCMS. So this is not a contemporaneous statement. This is a statement that's looking back at time and saying, I'm looking back at time and saying that these tests were properly conducted. And that, Your Honor, is a testimonial statement. It's exactly the sort of thing that came in Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts, where the Supreme Court said that violated the Confrontation Clause. Additionally, there were far more testimonial statements than just those statements. And in fact, during his testimony, Dr. Turner addressed what various statements meant that were included in the drug testing reports in the litigation packages. And at one point he referred to Form 2, which was the rescreen from the initial test. It's the rescreen in Prosecution Exhibit 1 for identification. And it's signed by a Kevin Sherman. And the description
and
next
it's
to...
it's entitled Chain of Custody.
Your Honor, and it said...
No, it's a chain of custody document.
And, Your Honor, Dr. Bruins testified that when Mr. Sherman signed the form, and this is Dr. Bruins' testimony, what he is saying is that the test worked, that everything was fine with the whole assay. He is looking at the body of work. So Dr. Bruins is saying that when Mr. Sherman signed that, he was making a testimonial statement. Again, this isn't my words. This is Dr. Bruins' words. What he is saying is the test worked. That is a testimonial statement that Kevin Sherman made on Form 2. And these statements, these documents are replete with such testimonial statements. Now, the government seeks to rely on the Washington case, and I'd like to address that in particular. First, Washington is entirely distinguishable from this case due to one key fact, and that is, in Washington, the government did not seek to admit the drug testing report. The drug testing report was not offered into evidence in the Washington case, and that comes from the Solicitor General's brief to the United States Supreme Court opposing certiorari in that case. In this case, again, the only issue that the government appealed was the military judge's ruling excluding the documents from being offered into evidence. So in Washington, the very issue, the only issue in front of this court, was not in front of the Fourth Circuit, because the government didn't seek to put those documents in. The government didn't seek the extra thumb on the scale that would come from a jury looking at the comparable person to Ms. Vallon and say, oh yeah, all the testing was done correctly. The comparable person to Mr. Dev certifying all the testing was done correctly. And it's that extra thumb on the scale that the establishment, that the Confrontation Clause will not admit. Furthermore, the government keeps on referring to the denial of certiorari in Washington. And the Supreme Court has said, the denial of a writ of certiorari imports no expression of opinion upon the merits of the case, as the bar has been told many times. And that's from the Carver opinion written by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Justice Frankfurter made this point repeatedly in cases such as Baltimore Radio Show, where he said, we've told the bar time and time again, the denial of cert implies no assessment of the merits of the case. And that's been repeated in such a recent landmark case as Teague v. Lane. So when the government repeatedly refers to the denial of certiorari, the Supreme Court itself has told courts, do not pay any attention to such an argument, and has warned the bar against making such an argument.
There was a U.S. District decision out of Maryland, Darden, where they addressed that, and the judge there dropped a footnote just saying that the court will not read the Supreme Court's cert denial in Washington as an implicit approval of the Fourth Circuit's ruling in that case. And then here's the qualifier, only that the decision is left undisturbed and remains precedent on this issue.
For the Fourth Circuit, that's correct, Your Honor, because that case was from the District of Maryland. Mm-hmm. So in the District of Maryland, a district court judge is required to follow Washington because it's a Fourth Circuit case. Of course, Washington is not at all binding on this court.
Oh, not binding, sure.
That's right. And again, it's a pre Melendez-Diaz case. It's not even persuasive. It was a split case. It was a 2-1 case. Now, additionally, Washington is also distinguishable on the facts. In that case, the Fourth Circuit repeatedly said that the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, when they performed the test, were essentially recording data. Again, that is not what we have in this case. We have a human being that wrote THC on a page 1 of Prosecution Exhibit 1. We have a human being who handwrote THC COC onto the first page of Prosecution Exhibit 2 for identification. A machine is not making these statements.
In the affidavit that was submitted by the government after the judge denied the admissibility, that drug lab commander referred to the DOD instruction 1010.16 that talks about the procedures for military personnel drug abuse testing program. And in there, it talks about reporting and keeping records, and it says the drug testing laboratory shall note test results on reporting forms required by the military department concerned. It seems that these people are chain of custody, and you go to the Melendez-Diaz footnote that would go to the weight, not the admissibility of this evidence.
Your Honor, when Ms. Townsend, I'll get back. That affidavit, by the way, Your Honor, is not properly before the court, and I'll address that in a moment. This court may not consider it. The Caps case in Cosio makes absolutely clear this court may not consider that affidavit, Your Honor. But when Ms. Vallon and Mr. Dev certified the laboratory results indicated on this form were correctly determined by proper laboratory procedures, that isn't a chain of custody concept, Your Honor. That isn't this item flowed from this space to this space. She is endorsing the procedural handling. She's endorsing the results. And again, the handwritten results THC in the first form, handwritten results THC COC in the second form. She is endorsing those results with the phrase that they were correctly determined by proper laboratory procedures. And let me quickly address why this court can't consider that affidavit. In the Cosio case, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces emphasized that in Article 62 context, this court doesn't have its normal fact-finding powers. This court is bound by the factual record that was determined by the military judge, and that document was put on immediately after the military judge denied the government's offer of the items into evidence. So when she ruled, that affidavit had not been presented to her. Judge Townsend couldn't possibly have abused her discretion by failing to consider something from a document that wasn't before her. So that document, as Cosio makes clear, cannot be considered by this court, Your Honor. It's also important to note that there was substantial testimony, as was mentioned before, about a false positive that occurred about 6 months after the testing results that were performed here. And let's put ourselves in that context. We know that in that case, Dr. Turner, who, by the way, was one of the people who handled, who dealt with the second sample in Senior Airman Scrady's case, we know that Dr. Turner signed a certificate, much like that signed in this case, saying that proper lab procedures had been used in that case, and indicating that an airman sample tested positive for THC when it didn't, when there was no THC in that airman sample. So the lab made an extremely serious mistake. And this gets right into what the Supreme Court was talking about in Melendez-Diaz about the value of the Confrontation Clause, one of the key values of the Confrontation Clause is that confrontation is designed to weed out not only the fraudulent analyst, but the incompetent one as well. So before a document comes in before the members indicating that appellant sample contained THC, indicating that appellant sample contained BZE, before that can occur, he has a right to examine the analyst that produced those statements. And one of the reasons he has that right is because the only constitutionally prescribed method for trying to weed out those fraudulent analysts, like Mr. Mills from the Army Crime Lab, that issue in the Loop case, like Dr. Turner from the sample that was tested later, the incompetent analyst like Dr. Turner in the sample that was tested later, the only way to weed them out is to allow the accused to cross-examine them. And it's the constitutionally prescribed manner. It is the greatest legal engine ever devised to tell the truth. And the accused has a constitutional right before the members receive this paperwork to subject the declarants to the crucible of cross-examination. So had Dr. Bruins testified on the stand for that airman whose sample erroneously tested positive, had he gone to a court-martial, Dr. Bruins would have said, oh yeah, we have procedures in place that would prevent that sample from having been reported out if it wasn't his sample. Because he testified to that there were procedures in place that should have led Dr. Turner to recognize that lab sample was not associated with that Social Security number. And if you say that you can't get Dr. Turner on the stand, then the accused is deprived of a chance to ever truly confront the witnesses against him, because he can't ask Dr. Bruins about what Dr. Turner did. He can't ask Dr. Bruins about whether Dr. Turner properly follows lab procedures. He can't ask Dr. Bruins about whether Dr. Turner, what we in the Department of the Navy would call gun-decked, his report in that instance. And Melendez-Diaz again says that the remedy, the constitutionally provided remedy for that, is confrontation. The court said, like the eyewitness who's fabricated his account to the police, the analyst who provides false results may, upon oath in open court, reconsider his false testimony. And of course, the prospect of confrontation will deter fraudulent analysts in the first place. So one of the key reasons, the Supreme Court has said that why we have the Confrontation Clause is to protect against conviction of the innocent. And we have a case here where an innocent airman, it was reported out to his unit that his sample was positive for THC. That was actually reported to his unit before, fortunately, somebody that was in the process of freezing the urine caught the mistake. And how does the legal system address that? Well, the Confrontation Clause and Melendez-Diaz tells us that the manner that is used to address that is to make these analysts subject to cross-examination. And before, again, the military judge correctly excluded the documents at issue in this case because they had not been the analysts who made statements, who made declaratory statements, who provided testimony in those documents, were not available to be cross-examined.
But didn't the record, when they were examining the expert and they were talking about the error in the second test, when it was running through the final testing, and he talked about the machines are very sensitive, and he focused on, his testimony was, the machines are doing the testing, it's not these people, the machines are doing the testing, and he's talking about that final test, it was the machine that did the testing. These people are just pushing that urine around.
And no, Your Honor, Dr. Bruins repeatedly testified that individuals are making statements when they fill out those forms that the tests were properly run. And as we, and again, it was Dr. Bruins' words, not mine, when he said that Mr. Sherman, what he is saying is that the test worked. But one of the very key pieces of testimony, Your Honor, is linking up a particular Social Security number with a particular lab accession number. So a it isn't a machine that makes that linkage; it's a human being. And a human being made a mistake in that linkage in the test where it was falsely reported to the unit that an airman's sample was positive for THC. So one of the many testimonial statements here is that the Social Security that Senior Airman Scrady's Social Security number is associated with this particular lab accession number, and that is a testimonial statement because it provides evidence that a reasonable, that an objective observer would anticipate being used in trial. It's important to note that that is one of the tests that the Supreme Court has expressly offered. Would a reasonable observer believe that this statement could be available for use at trial? And of course these statements are.
So you're saying that all urine samples going through, they should be expecting them to be used in trial?
Oh, no, Your Honor. No, Your Honor.
Okay, because isn't that where the Social Security and the land happen, is way before anything else? I mean, before the first test is even run?
It does, but one of the questions is, does an individual at Brooks Lab understand that any given report may be used later in a court? And the answer to that question is yes, and we know the answer to that question is yes, because Dr. Bruins testified to that, that one of the...
Low percentage, like less than 1%, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but...
Result, so go to trial.
But could it be introduced into trial? Yes, it could. Dr. Bruins actually testified that one of the missions of the drug lab there is to create documents for use at court-martial and admin discharge proceedings. And the military judge expressly made that finding of fact. It's clearly not erroneous. And as the court knows, in ruling on this motion, all facts have to be looked upon in the light most favorable to Senior Airman Scrady as the prevailing party. Certainly that wasn't an erroneous finding of fact. The military judge found that an objective observer would understand that. But look again, all there has to be, Your Honor, is just one testimonial statement on each of those documents, and it's inadmissible. And so looking again at the certificate on the first page, that certificate on the first page was done at least one day after the GCMS. So by the time Ms. Vallon certified Prosecution Exhibit 1, by the time Mr. Dev certified Prosecution Exhibit 2, they knew that the initial immunoassay was positive, they knew that the rescreen was positive, and they knew that the GCMS was positive. So now we're not talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands. Would an individual in that situation understand that statement that she's making, the laboratory results indicated on this form were correctly determined by proper laboratory procedures and that they are correctly annotated, would that person understand that that is available for use at a court-martial? Yes. Would the person who hand-wrote THC onto Prosecution Exhibit 1, would that person understand that that statement could be used at a court-martial? Yes. Would the person who hand-wrote THC-COC on the Prosecution Exhibit 2 understand that that statement could be used at a court-martial? The answer to that question, once again, is yes. I see I'm almost out of time, but before I stop, I'd like to see whether there are any other issues that the court would like to discuss. No. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bruce?
Yes, Your Honor. We disagree with the appellee. The government's appeal is contained in the government's brief. The government appeal is not filed when trial counsel submits a notice of appeal. That's simply a trigger mechanism to put the military judge on notice that the government is contemplating taking a government appeal. The record then has to be produced within 20 days, as this court knows. Then the appellate government division has 20 days to decide whether it's even going to appeal the case. So it's the brief filed by the United States, which is the government's appeal. And so we reject the notion from appellee that we lose because trial counsel didn't spell out everything in the notice of appeal. We've never articulated that Washington is binding upon this court. Of course it's not, but it's extremely persuasive when you consider the fact that it's another Department of Defense drug testing laboratory that utilizes expert testimony to admit, explain, and interpret drug testing results. It's our view that the United States Air Force goes above and beyond by also offering the drug testing report into evidence. We find great persuasive appeal in the Washington case. What is binding, not just persuasive, of course, is Magyari and Blazier. That's what was binding on the military judge. And again, no court of competent jurisdiction has overruled those binding cases. It was error for her to disregard them. I'd also like to note that the theme of Crawford, Davis, and Melendez-Diaz is the Supreme Court explicitly limiting the reach of their holdings in these cases involving whether or not a document is testimonial under the Sixth Amendment. They go to great lengths to limit their holding. They did so in Crawford, they did so in Davis, and they did so in Melendez-Diaz, leaving, therefore, as Kaff said in Magyari, leaving it to the lower courts to interpret, apply, and decide the particulars of any given case. That's what Kaff did in Magyari post-Crawford. That's what this court did post-Crawford in Blazier. We don't agree with the opponent's assertion about the lab commander's affidavit. We refer the court back to the record of trial. Where the military judge had the following exchange with trial counsel on the record after trial counsel offered the lab commander's affidavit for consideration by the military judge. Military judge, and can you articulate the purpose? Is this to be considered as part of your response to the motion in limine? STC, yes, Your Honor. If it could be considered as a supplement to that. Essentially, it supplements the testimony offered by Dr. Bruins with regard to specific circumstances about how the lab operates and that process. Of course it was before the military judge, and of course it's before this honorable court. And to suggest this court cannot consider it is mistaken. Appellee spoke about the primary purpose, but again, the primary purpose test in Davis, again, focused on whether or not the process in question looked back to some fact in the past or something that's ongoing. And that's exactly what you had in this case. You had technicians who put the appellee's urine into the machines, and the machine was looking at his urine at that time to determine if, at that moment in time, it contained drugs or not. There was no looking back to prove some past fact, as suggested by appellee. And as I was going to close on my opening comments, I want to go back briefly to the facts in the record that the judge obviously ignored when deciding whether or not these lab techs reasonably concluded that their data entries were going to result in them bearing testimony in a criminal trial in the future. Record 21, the lab follows, this is again Dr. Bruin's testimony, the lab follows the same procedure regardless of the basis of the test. Record 17, the lab receives 3,000 to 4,000 specimens a day. Record 17 to 18 and page 20. Lab personnel at all levels are under no pressure to obtain a particular result, negative or positive. Record 20. The critical issue at the lab is not the result, but making sure the machines work properly, the analysis is accurate, and the paperwork is correct. 22 and 42. 42 is where defense counsel cross-examined the expert. Printouts and raw data from the testing machines are produced by the machines at the same time as the tests are conducted. As the expert said, quote, exactly when the test is finished. Record 22, the machine printouts and reports are generated in the normal course of the lab's business, obviously qualifying for the business records exception that CAF in this court has recognized. Record 24, lab personnel don't have access to the member's medical record, don't know if they have a valid medical prescription, don't know if they're acting as a law enforcement informant who may have been required to take drugs, and don't have any personal identification information beyond the Social Security number. And finally, Record 25, the legal ramifications of any particular test are of no concern to the lab personnel because their role is to ensure the tests are properly conducted and reported. All of these are well-documented facts that you don't find in the military judge's written findings of fact and conclusions of law. She ignores those, she or missed them, and as a result, reached an erroneous conclusion of law that simply must be reversed by this court. In conclusion, the military judge was wrong on the law and must be reversed. Many, many airmen have been prosecuted for decades in the Air Force on the basis of drug testing reports and expert testimony, as the government attempted to do in this case. The United States respectfully requests that this court publish opinion affirming that Magyari and Blazer are in fact good law so that the field knows in fact that that still is the case as the United States is convinced it is. That these are still accurate pronouncements of law after Melendez-Diaz and that the military judge misapplied the law in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. Thank you for your arguments. The court will be issuing its opinion in due course. Court is adjourned.
All rise.